Hello and welcome to Bone, Stone, Obsidian, Dark Sun podcast. This is episode 302, and I'm your host, Robert, along with your host, Jesse. In this episode, we're going to talk about running Dark Sun at your tables. However, this episode, we had a little bit of an issue at the beginning of the recording, so we're just going to jump right into the news.
We've also got Encounters of Athas number 6, Red Rock Village from Adam Seasblack. This is a relatively generic Athasian village that you can drop into a map wherever you might need and just have a moderately flecked out village ready for PCs to stumble across.
And then we've got a Lawful Stupid blog number 7. This is on alchemy and herbalism. This is really a great blog. If you like alchemy and herbalism in your game, Mark has done a whole lot of work for that. So definitely check it out.
Oh, yeah. Meanwhile, over on the Facebook group, the Dark Sun Fans Facebook.
That tier has the iron mine, and I said, where's the copper mine and tin mines to make bronze? And the responses were really fantastic. Some people that really know what they were talking about, both in the game and real life, comments about that. Did you check that out?
Yeah, this is great stuff. I have a little bit of this going on in Sand Marches, where there's an area that has a copper mine. And if you check Dune Trader, of course, they mention which places import and export copper, which gives you part of the equation. But getting the full cycle of here's how you make bronze is great for groups that maybe aren't going to tier, are in some other part of the tablelands, or just don't want to deal with all the headaches of getting iron. Still want to get some metal weapons.
Yeah, and then Bob Drew asked about using the Deck of Many Things on Athas. So there was recently a 5th edition book called, I think it is the Deck of Many Things, that was just released. Right. And so that's kind of in people's thoughts right now. How about you? Have you ever used the Deck of Many Things on Athas?
I've used the Deck of Many Things, but I haven't done it to Dark Sun. But now that the opportunity comes up, that sounds like it might be an interesting thing to try. Meanwhile, Frederick LeClaire brought up a couple of cool maps that he picked up from some Patreons, the Winding Way map by MacGuffin and a Desert Path map by Dice Grimorium. Again, really easy to pick up and just place down in your virtual tabletop for whatever you need.
We were talking about the Dungeon 23. Well, this year they're doing Lore 24, and I started doing those for a place called the Feral Expanse, which is a place that could Ivios could easily fit into Dark Sun. The way I've placed it is sort of on the other side of the map. If you're using the, Athasian Cartographers Guild maps, this is like completely on the other side. So things are similar, but also quite different. So if you want to check those out, I've been posting those mostly daily or every couple of days, and we'll put the link in the notes.
I don't know. It sounds too much like a full-time job to me.
It is quite a bit.
There was a cute video on the Discord as well of people cooking with sand. It looked like it was some sort of potatoes from what I saw. Yeah. It got the sand superheated, so the sand itself was actually boiling, and he used that to heat up the potatoes. And then, of course, he cross-posted that into the Facebook group. So that's a neat little visual, and it would be a cool thing to have pop up in a Dark Sun game as a bit of flavor.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a great, way to not use water to cook. Mm-hmm. I put a call out for 5e writers and editors for an organized play campaign that June Solner and I are working on. So far, I've written 3 adventures for it, and we have a couple of people that have reached out to edit, but we still need writers. So if you want to message me if you're interested in participating, message me on the Discord, Facebook, or email me at radu@athas.org. It's RADDU. @athas.org. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, this for aspiring would-be game designers is a great way to get some initial experience, to know what it's like working with a team, to get feedback, to produce a completed draft, and then revise it, and then resubmit it, and go through the editing process. So for folks who are maybe thinking about, maybe I want to do some writing in the game industry, this is a great way to get some initial practice.
Yeah, for sure. That's basically how I got started as well. I I did some editing and then writing for the Ashes of Athas, the 4E campaign. Mm-hmm. So a friend of mine taught me how to paint and paint miniatures. I went over to his house one day. We painted for like 5 hours. He showed me all kinds of cool stuff, and he gave me some of his paints, and I painted some of the old original Dark Sun minis and some of the newer Gloomy Kids minis. So check those out in the Facebook group.
Yeah, it's always fun to find stuff like ancient world military figures and convert them into an Athas feel.
I have so many Dark Sun miniatures that I could just paint those forever, probably.
Yeah. Mark Hope's second edition actual play, To Tame a Land, is back, and he just posted an image of all the party characters for his upcoming season of the actual play. You can see what sort of characters are coming around this time. And he has mentioned that he's going to be playing through Black Flames and then all the way up to Black Spine. So that's going to be, for those who know this adventure, quite a jaunt. Premiering Sunday, February 25th, so just a few days after the Oscar cast might not get out in time, at 12 p.m. Yeah. Eastern on Twitch.tv/FlawfulStupid.
Yep, that will definitely have happened by the time this gets out. those adventures, you know, last time when they did their first episode or their first season, I actually was impressed at how quickly they moved through just all the adventures. So we'll see if they keep that breakneck speed up.
Black Flames in particular, there's a lot of empty rooms in the Palace of Thielba. So if you keep your nose down, you can move pretty fast in there. Mm. Meanwhile, 11-Foot Pole is on episode 11 of their Rime of the Frostmaiden conversion for Dark Sun, substituting sand for snow. And they are getting into Fort Iron, and you can see this on YouTube, and we'll have the links in our show notes.
Yeah, so I'd like to have some questions in this part of the show. So if you have some Dark Sun questions that you want to ask the podcast, send them to us at obsidian@athas.org. Well, let's get into it now. So we were talking about Dark Sun at the table. Jesse, what games are you currently running?
Right now, I am working as part of a team of DMs running the Sand Marches as a playtest. This is the complete Dark Sun campaign for second edition that I've been writing all through the pandemic. My editrix indicates that she's finished her first pass. She's just doing a couple of little bits and bobs here and there, and then the editing path of the book will be done. But to actually see what happens when the rubber meets the road, I released the preview draft version to a few additional DMs, and we've got a group going on Discord where I am helping to run through the entire campaign. And of course, we started with a small number of players, the third level, and we've grown to a player base of about 30-ish players using a West Marches style game. So games will run at different times when people are available. Groups will form dynamically. Some people have character trees and will switch characters depending on the adventure they're doing. And the early gameplay was a lot of survival adventure. We got to go and get food and materials and build up a settlement. And now the group has reached low mid levels, level 6, 7 characters, and for some of them anyway. And they are getting to the point of we need to defend what we have built from raiders and vagabonds out in the waste phase. So they are gearing up for a confrontation with a large raiding tribe and dealing with other local problems close to home, like something's been stealing food from their food supplies. And they blew a bunch of their supplies building a whole bunch of upgrades and facilities at their home base. But now that means they have to bring back more materials in order to keep their food supply stable and have enough materials for other emergencies. A lot going on.
Sounds like it.
What about you, sir? What do you got going on in the Dark Sun world?
So I've got 4 games actually going on. I've got Ashes of Athas. That's every other week about. And that's the 4th edition campaign's converted to 5th edition. I've got what used to be my tier game that is now Dreegoth Ascending. That's a 14th level game. We just started that. And I have another Dark Days of Tyr adventure, and that's a weekly, which has been awesome. They've been wanting to do something completely different, and so we're not doing the whole, you know, freedom slavery angle. We're doing I started to lean into the Yuan-T, so that's been fun. And then I just started a home game. We just on our actually first session last Sunday, and we already had a character die. We started at first level, and they're squishy.
You're living the Dark Sun dream.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how the game runs at your tables, Jesse. You're running second edition, and of course you're doing this Sand Marches thing, which is also very different from most normal games. How are you kind of finding working with the other DMs?
Well, we have a really good collaborative group. The Sand Marches campaign book gives the starting place for building out the game, but everyone knows that we have a lot of leeway to create our own encounters and add in storylines. So there's a map for the area that the players are exploring, and there's basic rules for using resources to build up your settlement. But then on top of all of that, people are layering in their own rich design and story elements. And we're getting... So every DM gets to add their own little story elements and their own special encounters. We talk behind the scenes about where the game is going and how to organize the scheduling. Adventures typically get tracked in an event log that we have on the Discord channel, and we keep track of what day we are in. The game has actually gone through its first in-game year of play. And that allows us to say, okay, this group goes out and does these things at this time, and another group is off in a different part of the map doing things at the same time. And then some of them return home on this day, and some of them return home on that day. This creates interesting time pressure dynamics where players are like, oh, some raiders showed up and they demanded tribute, and we have 30 days to pay them or figure out how we're going to defend the village from them. And so they have a timetable. And similarly, a character might say, I'm going to do psionic meditation using the rules from the Will and the Way and spend 50 days cloistered away working on power. Well, that's time that you're out of the game. You're not going on adventures, and you switch to another character in your character tree. Mm-hmm. Each of the DMs kind of has a flavor or a type of adventure that they like to run. So we can hit different cadences and different parts of the story. Also, when we have a lot of players available, sometimes we'll split up a table, say, oh, 12 people showed up to play. We'll split it into two groups of six, and a DM will take each group and head them off in separate directions. So the West Market format is working very well for asynchronous scheduling. We can just say, hey, one of the DMs has some time Wednesday night. Who wants to play? Since we got 30 players, we're going to get 4 to 6 people who are ready to show up for that. We can have people swapping characters on their character trees and getting advancement through their different gameplay. We get to use the character tree rules from second edition. So if a character gains a level, you raise one of your other characters in level as well, which means that people who are out there getting a lot of experience points have backup characters who are a little more advanced. There have been a few fatalities. I think 4 or 5 PCs have died so far in the campaign. A couple have retired out because the player decided the PC isn't really doing what I want them to do, or I feel like their goals are maybe untenable. Overall, so far, I would say it's been a pretty positive experience. We're dealing with the usual business of like community management and making sure that people get along and whatnot. Folks don't have to be friends, but they do need to be able to play with each other in a mature and respectful fashion. And that's normal when you have a big group like this.
Right.
One of the things that is interesting is seeing all of the weird rough edges of second edition AD&D and then going diving for obscure rulings in Sage Advice or Polyhedron Magazine. And some of them have rulings. Some of them have rulings that are clearly mistakes. And some of them, there's errors that were just never addressed. And then we have to get together and arrive at a consensus with the DM saying, how do we want to rule on this? What do we think we should do in order to make this work? Second edition really lends itself to a lot of rock, scissors, paper kind of gameplay. If you've got a really potent power, it often is like, this is my winning move until you run into the guy that's got the move that counters it. So like a second edition half giant swinging a long spear at a large target is doing 3d6 damage, plus anywhere from 10 to 14 from strength and maybe some specialization, the gladiator or fighter. Ridiculous amounts of damage. But then the moment that, someone throws dominate on that guy psionically, now he's the party's problem. Similarly, we had a group that encountered a pretty tough monster, and the psionicist was just like, I throw control body on it and power manipulate it so that it doesn't get a resistance roll. Oh, okay, it's done. Counter's over.
Nice. So
so
you've
what
been running.
about you?
Well, hold on. I want to ask you a question.
Oh,
You've been
sorry. Okay.
running your
Thought we were
sand
going back and forth.
marches. Compared to like how you wrote it, has it been kind of going how you thought?
Some parts of it are going much like I thought. Players are slowly working their way out on the map away from the starting settlement. They are engaging with the system for bringing back materials and building up the settlement and trying to get into a full village or town. And they've been running into various areas out in the waste, doing diplomacy with other groups that they find, fighting lots of monsters. So all of that is working much as intended. But one of the things that was interesting is that at the very beginning, there were some players who were used to D&D just being like, oh, there's no rules for building a windmill or something. So I just want to throw money and spells at it to do this thing. Then I have to back them and go, no, we have a formal system here, a set of rules that is like between adventures, you can build these things, and it's sort of like a mini SimCity game. You can build these improvements to make your settlement better, but you have to spend thus and such resources to do so. And some PC has to manage it, which uses up their downtime between adventures, putting that time crunch on them again. We've often gotten cases where PCs are like, oh, I need to spend my downtime to level up, because you use your downtime to train when you advance level. But we really need someone to oversee building a well or building an animal pen or something for supplies. So getting PCs invested in, okay, we have a special set of additional rules that we layer on for managing the settlement. It's a little bit of an education. And then once we did that, people were all in, and folks are like making characters specifically to address specific gaps and taking non-weapon proficiencies that normally no one would ever take, and then talking about making their own custom projects. What if we did this and this and this and make all kinds of different unusual things? So much so that it's prompted me to start writing expansion books already for Sand Marches, which the final isn't even out yet. But I'll have an expansion book shortly after it releases, with new projects and rules for converting your settlement into a full-on town, and maybe eventually even a city. Another one of additional types of encounters and unusual features that you can find out in the desert. So the players have really jumped onto all of this stuff, and it's created so much creative momentum that I'm just like, yes, let's add this all in and create some more material for it.
Nice, that sounds awesome.
Are so good.
Nice. So for my games, they're all sort of different. Some one of them's like completely homebrew, another is, working off organized play and a high level adventures. And so they I think they all have in common that, I think fifth edition runs pretty smoothly and I know it well enough that when players do weird things and all of a sudden I have to come up with a random encounter or whatever, I can usually convert stuff on the fly. One of the things that has really actually helped me with that is The Forge of Foes. There's a fifth edition book by my friends Teos Abadia, Mike Shea, and Scott Fitzgerald Gray, and all that book is just completely about monster building, and really, the thing that it has in it is an updated CR table. So they did a lot of math crunching and updated the CR table, and I've been using that. They also have these really cool templates, so like you can have a monster at certain levels, and it gives you a template on how to change it, and it just makes everything real fast. Like I can just use the template as a base and then add, you know, whatever it needs, whatever psionics it needs and whatnot, to make a monster. So I think that's been the part that's kind of been the most difficult, but at the same time, the probably the most fun, just kind of making those. I have kind of felt that, you know, people say that fifth edition is, you know, too soft on characters, and it is hard to kill characters once they are higher level, even, you know, 10th level. It gets very difficult. But I've just learned what to do to kind of not necessarily counteract that, but just to make it challenging for them. And that really has a lot to do with just like in fourth edition, you know, at the latter days of fourth edition, the combats were taking forever. And so we just pretty much like halved the hit points of monsters and doubled their damage. So like they only lasted a couple of rounds, but they did some damage. And so I've been doing a little bit of that, kind of just making monsters hit harder, but then they die sooner. So that's been fun too.
What's been your standard basically for converting over psionic abilities to work in fifth edition? That's a big hurdle that a lot of people have different rubrics for. Would you say is yours?
So I'm really leaning into the fifth edition way of doing things, which is to kind of have their own features. And so each psionic power, you know, if I am fully converting a monster, you know, I'll look at the second edition version and see which psionics it has. And a lot of times they really have a lot of psionics. You know, a monster is only going to be alive for 3 or 4 rounds of combat, so they don't need 8 powers necessarily. And so I kind of figure out which ones are going to be the most likely to be used, which are usually, you know, their sciences most likely. And so I will convert those, and I just convert those as sort of separate features instead of kind of going the whole like spell version. Although I do that occasionally when there are monsters that are very, you know, that are almost like wizards, where they have a lot of powers that are wide, you know, and they could use a lot of different things. And so sometimes I'm just like, this just works as this wizard spell. Of course, the players don't ever see that. They just see the psionics happening essentially. And then I've also started to do a lot of the way I think I'm doing psionics is a lot of opposed roles, just kind of like it was in second edition. But just to make it feel different than kind of both, you know, regular combat or casting spells and just getting saving throws. And this way, pretty much everything is an opposed role. So I've been trying to pull that in as well.
Interesting. I presume that you've, excuse me, established a large folder of Dark Sun monsters that you've slid over to fifth edition.
I do. Yeah, I have a bunch of those. And it's I run most of my games in Fantasy Grounds. I just started running in person, and so that's been interesting. It probably took me 3 hours to get all of my stuff together to run in person again. It's just spread everywhere because it's been, you know, years since I've really run in person. But running on Fantasy Grounds has been great. That so each, you know, each game has a separate folder, a separate game, but the cool thing is that you can export each game as sort of a module is what they're called, and then I can open those in other games, and so I can use all the same monsters, you know, from one to the other. I don't have to like
Right, you don't have to
have
redo
to
all the
copy them
work.
over, but don't have to keep creating them. Yeah, which is cool. So when you're running your games, has there been anything that the players really surprised you with? Or that you're like, oh, I should have put this in the original one, or just something that's really thrown you off.
Well, there were some things that they did that I had planned for. Like a couple of people made water clerics early on, and I thought like, yes, good. This is the right idea. you are going into a situation of resource scarcity, have someone to cover for that. And that paid dividends for them. And there were a couple of early expeditions where the PCs didn't have a water cleric, and it was a little dicey. They were like, are we going to find something to survive on? Major things have been PCs looking for interesting ways to use their proficiencies and their powers to create special projects. To say, oh, I want to build a project that allows me to use animal telepathy to create a spy network of creatures that tell us if raiders come close to our territory. Or I want to use my knowledge of engineering and architecture to build a Yakchal, an ice house that functions in the desert by using evaporative cooling to reduce temperatures in a lowered area. And all of these have created interesting opportunities for the players to be able to pursue those sorts of goals. For me to go, okay, you want to do this thing, and I can see that being reasonable, and so now I'm going to give you some tasks that you must complete in order to do that. One of the other things that really surprised me is I left the door open to, if it's in the original box set or if it's a character type that appears in the revised set, you can play it. And we got a bunch of defilers. And I was a little surprised, because when you're playing with the original box set rules, defiling is a hard road. You get a slightly better advancement table, which means that on average you're going to be one level higher than other magic users. But you can't do anything to hide your defiling magic, short of using magic items. It's, you cast a spell, your defiling effect goes off, everybody knows what you are. And this is a problem. And I even flat out told players, like, you can play a defiler if you really want to. If the villagers find out, you're going to get stoned to death in your sleep or driven out of the village. That's how it is. But a bunch of people played defilers, and I honestly thought that people would be more cautious about playing defilers because, you know, the idea of, well, I'm one level higher than other wizards doesn't seem like that much of a bonus. It's like, it's nice, but it's not huge. And I always thought, like, oh, there people talk a lot about, should defiling magic have other bonuses? Should you get free spells or spells that you cast at a higher effective level or something like that? Didn't need it. People were ready to go, you know, whether because they wanted that extra level or because they wanted to be an anti-hero or whatnot. We got several of them. One of the interesting side effects of this was that a couple of people went for some of the kits from Defilers and Preservers that have alternate power sources. And there's often a lot of debate in the community about, like, should you even have these kits in your game? Because it sort of takes the sting out of defiling. And what these players discovered is that when you actually use the rules for those kits, it's not a net win. There was a character who was a shadow mage and didn't realize until actual play that that meant every time that the character cast a spell, the player had to make a constitution check. And if it failed, the spell failed because they touched the black and got damaged by it, and then the spell fizzles out. It's like, okay, I'm going to try and get around the defiling, and the cost is that 40% of the time my spells just fizzle. We had another character that was a Cerulean who learned the hard way that, like, after several months of play, because the game's gone for over a year in-game, you start making saves to see if you get your alignment shifted toward evil and the spirits of the Cerulean Storm start suggesting you and causing you to do terrible things by influencing you while you're drawing on the power of the storm. And when you cast multiple spells in an area, it draws in the storm and you get these massive deluges and hailstorms and unnatural storms that are causing damage to the landscape. So, like, if you're fighting to defend one of your settlements or outposts, and then your Cerulean casts a bunch of spells, your outpost is going to get shellacked by a tear storm showing up. And, wow. We came super close in a very recent game. One player playing a Cerulean mage got hit with a shatter spell. And if he had failed his saving throw, it would have shattered his blue crystal lens, and that would have been it for his spell casting for a while. He made his save, luckily, for him.
Wow. So what has happened to those defilers?
So a lot of the defilers have basically realized, okay, I need to either get off the sauce and convert over to being a preserver, like they describe in Defilers and Preservers, or I need to find an alternate casting method that I think that I can live with. So, like one of them is thinking, well, maybe necromancy, the gray necromancer kit, is a better idea. The idea of using the gray to power my spells. And another one is like, I probably need to give up my alternate power source and just study to become a preserver with one of the preserver PCs because this is not a tenable solution. But yeah, it was very interesting to me. I think that there's this perception, or at least there was coming into the game, that defiling doesn't have negatives that are hard enough to really offset the benefits that you might get from it story-wise or XP-wise, and that the alternate power sources were an easy way to avoid some of those penalties. And turns out neither of those were true.
That's awesome. So what is the kind of storyline? Is the storyline more about the exploration, or is it more about their settlement, or how, like, what's going on?
So that changes as the players gain levels or the characters. At the start, it's a survival game. You appear on the edge of the map in the desert. You're a refugee with a group of other refugees, and you have no food and no water, and you have to go and find something to eat before you starve to death. And then once that's done, you've got a tiny little settlement set up with all these survivors eking out a marginal living, and your goal is to explore so that you can find stuff that you can bring back to the settlement, food or materials, things that you can use to build up your little pile of rocks and refugees and turn it into something better. And for the early game cycle, the expeditions were always, we're going out and we're mapping, we're exploring the desert, and we'll find strange things and ancient ruins and monster lairs. And sometimes we just put a note and then we leave. Other times we go in and hack up some monsters, and someone dies from poison, and a bunch of characters get badly wounded, and we're like, ah, too much, we're out. And then they send another expedition later to finish it off and haul things back. And then in between expeditions, they're building up the settlement and constructing a well and a palisade and training a militia and so on, with the materials they brought back and the skills that their characters have. Now that the village is very well established, they've attracted the notice of raiders out in the waste who are like, hey, that nice village you got there, it'd be a shame if something happened to it. So you're going to pay us tribute, or we're going to come in and kick over your anthill. And the PCs are trying to figure out, how do we protect our village and stop them? And discussing, maybe we pay them the tribute so that they stay off our backs for a year. And then when they come back next year, we're higher level and we try and kick their teeth in. But other PCs have said, once you pay the Dane Guild, you never get rid of the Dane. And, they will keep coming back if we pay them, and the price is going to go up and up and up. And so the PCs have some hard choices to make, and they know that the raider tribe is big and has defilers and psionicists and warriors. So they're like, our group is relatively small by comparison. How do we run a defensive battle where we can protect our village and all of our outposts? At this point, they've also made friends with a few other settlements that they've discovered in the wastes, and they've got a little bit of trade going on, and they helped some of the settlements with some various problems. One of the settlements, several of the people that lived there got killed, but if the PCs hadn't intervened, they would have been wiped out. So they're sort of like, oh, this isn't great, but it's better than it could have been. And as they are working with these settlements, they're hearing stories about weird things even deeper in the desert. There's an Arakocra who did some aerial scouting and spotted a mountain far, far to the southeast. They know there's another raider camp that's not related to the one that's currently threatening them. It's way out east in the salt flats. They know that there's a giant tower of obsidian down in the Deadlands to the south. And so they all are looking at these sort of things with hungry eyes, going, we're not tall enough for that ride yet, but maybe in a couple of levels we'll send an expedition down there and we'll if we could find something interesting. So their goals change as they get the ability to solve a particular problem. That door closes and another door opens. They find the next problem to deal with and keep going from there. There was a interesting sort of side scene that ran recently where they're in a bit of a time crunch because they've only got so much time before the Raiders show up and say, you have to pay us tribute now or we set everything on fire. And also they have to deal with whatever the food thief is that's endangering their food supply, like right away before they run out of food. And this meant there was there happened to be a night that was available for me to run. One of the other DMs wanted to get a chance to play and hadn't gotten to play a lot. And so it was like, okay, we can run an adventure, but how do we fit it into the timetable? And I thought about it a little bit, and then I said, ah, I know how to run an adventure that takes 0 days. And I ran a time travel adventure that had an Arakocra psionicist who came from the future and was off course, wound up at the village, and was like, I'm being chased by people from the future, and I need your help, and it's important for reasons that I'll explain to you, but we need to leave this place right now. And shenanigans ensued, and I think everyone had a good time, and I liberally lifted Story Beats from Terminator, and it went very well. And in game, it took no time because they returned home mere seconds after they left.
That's awesome.
I think we lost you on the camera.
I just switched it.
I only see me right now.
Right. We got them both. You were talking, so I
Ah,
put it
okay.
on you.
Gotcha. So tell me more about what you've been doing with yours. Like, where are the PCs in terms of story? Are you doing it in free year one or 10 or your own timetable?
So with the Dregoth Ascending, that one has been a little bit tricky because it is still earlier than. So originally, Dregoth Ascending is kind of written after the events of the Prison Pentat, and I wanted to still include it. So I kind of said, like, a few sessions ago, that the PC started hearing rumors that Abalakare of Rom has been killed. And so, that got at least got her dead or missing or whatever she is. That way, the events of Dregoth Ascending could happen. So we're technically, I think we're in like free year five. There's been a couple of times in the campaign. We started like right after Kallak died, and then the characters became like the heroes of Tyr, and a couple of times we've jumped ahead a year or so in between sort of big events happening.
Right.
So that's where that one is. One thing that one of my players did say was like, well, what's the dragon doing right now? And I'm like, that's a real
You
good
really want to
question
know?
because he's not there. And so what, if Dregoth is attacking Rom, why is the dragon not there? So I'll have to think of something for that. That'll come up in the future to explain it.
Dragon's got his own shit.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Maybe he's out in out in the Crimson Sphere somewhere dealing with someone.
Yeah, that would be a great idea, actually, tie into that. Or he's doing his side gig of door dashing.
Which actually does tie into that because recently they did find a Sirlon ship. So we were already talking about stuff in the Crimson Sphere, so we might end up going out there.
Sweet. So how does the 5e framework work with resource scarcity for your group?
Well, so for that Dregoth Ascending group, it's pretty much over now because they have a druid that has Windwalk. And so they can travel 60 miles an hour, anywhere to anywhere. So it's real quick for them to get anywhere now, which is cool for, like, oh, we just want to get to Dregoth Ascending. Like they're just there, in I think we figured out it took them like 8 hours to get there. So it's been funny. And then for the Ashes of Athas game, I'm running that pretty much like by the book of those adventures. And so they just sort of gloss over any travel time because, usually it's just like unless it's travel is like part of the adventure. But between adventures, it just sort of gets glossed over. But during the adventures, it's definitely been an issue, although not a heavy issue because that's not the focus of that campaign. And so, you know, it's been there, but it hasn't been a major obstacle. It's much more focused on sort of the story of what's going on there. And then,
well, sorry.
No, good.
I was going to ask, early in the campaign, when the PCs had to worry about food and water, what did you do? Like, creating water is pretty easy in fifth edition, and it creates a lot of water. Similarly, good berry is a very low level spell, and even though it's transmutation, it conjures berries out of nothing, which takes care of your food needs. So what did you do to make the players feel the pinch?
Yeah, so with those, I just drastically cut them down. So with create water, it only creates 2 gallons of water, which is really, I also run like little harsher rules. I run that you have to have 2 gallons of water a day for a regular person. And that's like double what the regular player's handbook kind of says. And what most people use, I think most people probably use the gallon because that's what was in the original box set. But from personal experience, if I am out hiking all day in the desert, I'm drinking 2 gallons of water. I'm drinking 8 quarts of water. So
yeah. I think the typical Athasian probably has kidney problems.
Yeah. So I think it's important, and not necessarily important, but I just think it's fun. I just think it's better to say, like, you need a lot of water. Like, what are you going to do about it? And so,
an interesting side effect of that is 2 gallons of water is 16 pounds. So right. You're really hitting the carrying capacity for the party.
Yep. And then in the home game, I just started a little knowledge. And so that's been, they are just like running on empty. What I do also is, you know, use the exhaustion. So if you don't have enough food and water, then you're not really going to get a good night's sleep. So you're not going to get none of your exhaustion is going away. And then if you don't have enough food and water, you've got to make a con save or you get a level of exhaustion. And so people are, you know, having 2 levels of exhaustion, which is the really scary part of that exhaustion track. I've also been playing with, making exhaustion 10 levels, and then, which they did in one of the Unearthed Arcanas, although I've kind of segregated it more. But the purpose of that is to have both food and water be very difficult, and so therefore you'll be going through more levels of exhaustion. So there would be like, you know, your physical exhaustion, and then your hunger, and then your thirst, as sort of all separate things, but that all contribute to your overall exhaustion.
Nice. And as I recall, you use exhaustion in combat as well, that things who go down in a fight take exhaustion, which helps to prevent players just recklessly running in or getting healed instantly and being back on their feet.
Yep, exactly. There's, you know, I've run a ton of games in 5th edition, just regular D&D games when I was doing Adventurers League. And that was a tactic that I often saw, which makes sense. It is a good tactic. And that is wait till somebody goes down before you heal them, because they are taking whatever they take beyond zero. It doesn't matter in 5th edition. And so therefore, you know, as long as it's not like some obscene amount where it's going to kill the character automatically, even if they have 1 or 2 hit points and they go down, then you heal them. So they've taken whatever that negative is. Maybe say they took 15 points of damage, but they had 2 hit points. So they've taken all that 13 points of damage and then it just disappeared by itself. Now I heal them. Now they're up again and they have, you know, whatever hit points. Whereas if you would have healed them first and then they would have gotten hit, they would have soaked up all of that damage in their actual hit points. So it does make sense why people do it, but it also, it's one of those just weird artifacts of play, right? That kind of feels weird. And so to combat that, I give people exhaustion. That way, you know, people don't want to go down at all.
Right. And this also encourages people to use their healing resources during combat, because normally people think tactically that if you spend your turn healing, that's a turn that you're not doing damage to the enemy. And so healing, if you think you can survive, is usually considered a wasted turn. But now preventing that exhaustion becomes crucial, and so you may want to heal someone just to keep them able to soak that additional damage, and then you've got the one person healing while the other person's fighting. So it creates more of that tactical dilemma.
Right. And going back to
Very
what you were
cool.
asking before about the water, about the good berries, I say that they have to have berries. It doesn't just create berries out of nothing. So they have to have berries in order to make them. And then even if they make them, it just gives them the hit point. It doesn't give them the food.
It's interesting to me that this is probably a very late change in the 5e Player's Handbook, because good berries in the Transmutation School, which implies that it takes an existing thing and changes its qualities, but then in the
Right.
spell description it says that it creates the berries. So I'm suspecting that that was something that got changed so late that they didn't manage to make those two mesh.
Right.
It actually came up in Sand Marches as well, because good berries available there as a second level spell. In second edition, it is explicit that it transforms an existing berry, so you must have a berry to turn it into a good berry. But taxonomically, this was a fun thing to discover actually in play. Cactus fruits are considered berries, so legal
Nice.
target for a good berry.
That's a good idea.
Who
Yeah.
knew? Wasn't me until I had to look it up.
Running your game, like, do you guys plan what sort of, like, who's running what, or is it just whenever somebody's available?
It's half and half. Like, if someone has availability, then we want to give players the opportunity to jump in. If I suddenly discover that I'm going to have Friday night free, I might just post in the Discord channel and say, "Hey guys, I got Friday night free. Let's form an expedition." But we also try to plan some things in advance, especially when it comes to important moments like the raiders are going to come and attack the village. We're going to organize three different groups that are going to be run by different GMs, possibly on different days in the real world, but in the in-game calendar, it's all happening at the same time. And we're going to get the players in to fight against the bandits at these events. That way we know, okay, we've hit this choke point. We have to resolve the bandit threat against the settlement. We're going to solve it by this day over a course of so many adventures. And then we can move back on to players organizing their own expeditions and things of that nature.
Nice. And did you ever think that you would be running it for like 30 people? Has it sort of held up to that stress?
It has survived the stress test quite well, in my opinion. But the playtest has definitely gotten me a lot of useful feedback. Like there's a section just at the beginning of chapter three now that says in all bold text, "This book is just the starting place. You are expected to generate your own stories and encounters and locations and add them in." Because at first the other DMs in the group were like, "Well, this is the campaign, so this is what we can use, and we can't do anything that's not listed here." I'm like, no. This is literally just a giant sandbox, and these are the random things that could happen, but you all should totally be building additional stuff." And to their credit, the DMs have taken that and run with it, and they've created new settlements and new villains and new adventures. And it's been fantastic. I didn't expect to have like a full-on 30 players and multiple GMs shared thing right off the back of the box like this. When I first said, "Hey, I want to run a Sand Marches playtest and I'm going to use it West Marches style," I thought I might get a dozen players and that I would just be running the occasional game and half of the players would show up for any given session. But it's proven to be quite popular, and having a team of DMs makes it possible to accommodate a large group like this. And it's been a real treasure. We've got some immensely wonderful role players in the group, and as a result, we get really good character stories. We've got some people who draw their own character art for it, and DMs creating lots of interesting dilemmas. So it's been wonderful.
Nice. So tell me about the Discord. I am constantly getting pinged by, there's so much activity in there. People talking in the chat channels and the in character chat, out of character chat. Talk about that.
Right. So we So knowing that this is all going to be run through Discord and then using a virtual tabletop for all of our map and character record support, and then I have a wiki that I organized that has some of the Dark Sun rules on it, specifically for people who need reference for, oh, how does this kit work, or what is this weird Dark Sun spell for an obscure source book? I did a lot of planning about how do we want to organize this. So we've got an in-character chat, we've got an out-of-character chat, we've got a channel for just introducing new characters so that that doesn't get clogged up with a lot of chatter. Instead, it's just here's every character that has joined the game, typically with a short paragraph description about them and a picture if the player has one handy. We've got a channel that is just the graveyard for people who have died. We have a channel for resource tracking, so that is specifically just for tracking the community's food, water, security, materials, and all the things that they have built. And separating out the channels like this means that it's much easier for us to keep track of things without stuff getting lost. We'll use threads as well and pinned messages. So, for instance, there's a post in the resource tracking channel that's got, here's what resources the village have right now, and this is pinned. You can always find it, and I can go in and edit it if the players bring stuff back or if they use the resources to build a house or what have you. And this separation of channels means that it's not just one giant channel that's getting completely messy with everyone posting everything that comes up. We keep things segmented to specific topics. Then we have a trio of, well, four voice channels. We've got a pair of adventure channels, March's voice channels, so we can be running a couple of groups at the same time if multiple DMs are available. We have one that's called a fireside chat channel, and this is just an open role-playing channel. People want to just have their characters chit chat, but do it through live chat. They can drop in there anytime. It doesn't require any supervision from us. Because we're not a PvP game, we're a cooperative game, we don't have to worry about, oh, I need a DM so that I can murder this guy. It doesn't happen in this campaign. And we have a backstage channel for the DM so that we can get together and discuss issues and plans and ideas as we need them. There's a few other ancillary channels, but that's the general sort of structure. It's like the settlement and all of its resources and construction in game, out of game. Oh, and the event log, which basically anytime that we run an adventure, the DM writes up an event log that says, here's what the players did in this adventure. And then at the very end, here's the XP they got, here's the treasure they got, and the PCs write, and here's what I do with my downtime after this adventure. Because each time you go on an expedition, you get a little bit of downtime to recuperate afterward, and you can do one thing with that time. So players will say, oh, I'm going to research a spell, I'm going to do item creation, I'm going to use a crafting skill, I'm going to go carousing.
So with that downtime,
It's busy at all hours. We've got people from Australia, people from Europe, as well as, of course, a lot of people in the US.
So with the downtime, like, is that was that part of second edition, or did you make up a bunch of stuff? Because
No,
there's
the
gonna
along
be.
with the oh, sorry, along with the settlement construction, this is part of the rules that I created for Sandmarchers specifically. It was the idea that in between expeditions, you have a limited amount of time to do other things. And so you constantly have pressure of, we need to build stuff to support our village. We need to train militia. We need to build a palisade. We need to dig a well. And PCs must oversee these projects. So you go on an expedition and you come back with XP and treasure and materials. And then you do your downtime to spend those things to improve the community or do things that your character wants to do. Downtime in this sort of highly structured format isn't really a property of second edition. So it's one of those things that we gotta peek people when they come in. They're like, oh, I'm used to playing D&D and it's just about going on adventures and killing stuff. I'm like, okay, we have a cycle here. You go on an expedition, then you come back and you get a downtime. And since leveling up requires a downtime, it's a very important part of your character cycle. It also means that you get things like a player wants to research making a spell, but they need a downtime to do it. Have to go on an expedition because you do the expedition, then you get the downtime. So go on an expedition, don't die, come back, use your downtime to do the spell research. And while that might seem like a little heavy-handed, why can't I just sit at the settlement and spend my time there researching spells as long as I have the money? It's because it's a mechanic that deliberately pushes players to get out there and be involved and have adventures and go on these expeditions and interact with other PCs. It's in the design philosophy of reward the behavior you want to see. I want to see players get out there and have expeditions with other people, so you get rewards for doing that. And one of those rewards is getting the chance to do the projects you want to do.
Nice. With there being so many players, how are the, like, are there plot lines that revolve around the players and the their main location?
The settlement has some storylines that are directed at it. Like the raiders are coming for the settlement because it's prosperous. You know, the PCs made a successful village, so now raiders want to steal all their stuff. Some characters also have been starting to pursue personal storylines. One of the PCs is a barbarian from a tribe that got destroyed, you know, and scattered to the winds, and he thought that he was a lone survivor, and then they met another barbarian from his tribe, and they were like, oh my gosh, I thought everyone else was dead, and you know, having their great Arnold Schwarzenegger and Carl Weathers moment, you know. And then there's other characters who are doing things like pursuing information about what's going on with the Cerulean Storm. The Cerulean wizards are like, oh, well, the Cerulean Storm's got Tithian's disembodied spirit in it, and sometimes he tries to tell us to do things, but also we get knowledge and power from the storm, so try to ignore his voice as best you can. And then there was a storyline where they met an NPC Cerulean wizard who apparently was a demonologist who was talking to demons in the storm and was like, Tithian, who's that? I don't know what you're talking about. And they're sort of, maybe the Cerulean Storm isn't everything we thought it was. Maybe it's something else. The time travel plot line that I mentioned earlier had some directed character development, and some of the PCs take it on themselves to do interesting things to create their own goals, to be self-motivated, and those are perfect opportunities to grab on to hooks that they give us and go, okay, we will take this and we will drag you in an interesting direction with it because you've signaled that you want to do this thing. So let's do it and see what happens.
Nice. So you mentioned Tithian. So are you like after the novels or do you have a timeline?
So the timeline has so far been deliberately obscured. It's known to be after the death of Kallak. Kallak is dead. Tyr is a free city. Some PCs know this and news has started to get around. At first, you know, when it came up, someone was like, Kallak is dead. Tyr is a free city. And other people were like, what? No, that's got to be a rumor. But they know for a fact now that that's true. But they don't know what free year it is. They don't know what's going on really in the other city states. Their information about the outside world is limited and they have plenty to keep their hands full. So it's not like someone's going to be going to Valak and knocking on and dropping us a door and saying, hey, excuse me, do you have the dark lens? It doesn't come up because they got other problems. So they know that there's some stuff in motion. Some things have happened sort of like in the books, but maybe not everything in the books is true or accurate. And this is one of the things that we've been sort of gently nudging the PCs about, is that a lot of people here are huge Dark Sun nerds because, you know, we're hanging out in a Discord for second edition Dark Sun players. The things that they believe to be true about the lore and the canonical status of the world might not be 100% accurate. Some big things are known to be true. Other things are kind of up in the air. The aforementioned, like, maybe Tithian's not the only thing going on in the Cerulean Storm.
Nice. Well, we are just pushing an hour now, so I think that's probably going to do it for us for tonight. And we'll see what we're going to talk about next time. I still want to talk more about kind of running stuff at the table. We'll have to figure out what exactly our topic is going to be, though.
You know, we could probably do at least half an hour about weird, obscure, edge casey, and unclear stuff and how we solved various rules things that came up.
That's a great idea. Yeah, I'm sure we could each talk about that for our respective games.
In the meantime, our listeners should definitely send some messages in and say, what do you guys want to hear about? What would you like for us to talk about? You want us to explain how the revised psionic system works and doesn't work? Or do you want to hear more about Robert's 5th edition rules? You know, let us know.
Yeah, and if you have any of those edge cases, let us know those too. So Jesse,
oh, so many edge cases.
Where can we find you online?
So I'm on the Dark Sun group on Facebook, and of course I'm in the Discord channel because that's where we run fan marches. I also occasionally pop up on Blue Sky. Let's see, I think that's about it at this point. Gosh, I don't have nearly as many social media accounts as I thought I did. What about you, Robert?
Pretty much the same. I am in the Discord, on the Facebook group, on Athos.org in the arena, and on Patreon and Start Playing as well. So check those out. But if you have questions and you want to ask about the podcast, anything about Dark Sun, just send them to obsidian@athos.org. And that's going to do it for us. Have a good night.
All right. Have a good night, Robert.